No man chooses evil because it is evil. He only mistakes it for happiness, the good he seeks. Mary Wollstonecraft.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Mortal Instruments, Book 5, City of Lost Souls, by Cassandra Clare. Read by Molly Quinn.
Prologue. Simon stood and stared numbly at the front door of his house. He'd never known another home. This was the place his parents had brought him back to when he was born. He had grown up within the walls of the Brooklyn row house. He played on the street under the leafy shade of the trees in the summer and had made improvised sleds out of garbage can lids in the winter. In this house, his family had sat Shiva after his father had died. Here he had kissed Clary for the first time. He had never imagined a day when the door of the house would be closed to him. The last time he had seen his mother, she had called him a monster and prayed at him that he would go away. He had made her forget that he was a vampire, using glamour, but he had not known how long the glamour would last. As he stood in the cold autumn air, staring in front of him, he knew it had not lasted long enough. The door was covered with signs, stars of David splashed on in paint, the incised shape of the symbol for Chai, life. Tefillin were bound to the doorknob and knocker. Ahamsa, the hand of God, covered the peephole. Numbly put his hand to the metal mezuzah affixed to the right side of the doorway. He saw the smoke rise from the place where his hand touched the holy object, but he felt nothing. No pain. Only a terrible, empty blackness rising slowly into cold rage. He kicked the bottom of the door and heard the echo through the house. "Mom!" he shouted. "Mom, it's me!" There was no reply. Only the sound of the bolts being turned on the door. His sensitized hearing had recognized his mother's footsteps, her breathing, but she said nothing. He could smell acrid fear and panic even through the wood. "Mom!" His voice broke. "Mom, this is ridiculous! Let me in! It's me, Simon!" The door juddered as if she had kicked it. "Go away!" Her voice was rough, unrecognizable with terror. "Murderer! I don't kill people!" Simon leaned his head against the door. He knew he could probably kick it down, but what would be the point? "I told you, I drink animal blood!" "You killed my son," she said. "You killed him and put a monster in his place!" "I am your son. You wear his face and speak with his voice, but you are not him! You're not Simon!" Her voice rose to almost a scream. "Get away from my house before I kill you, monster!" "Becky," he said. His face was wet. He put his hands up to touch it, and they came away stained. His tears were bloody. "What have you told Becky?" "Stay away from your sister!" Simon heard a clattering from inside the house, as if something had been knocked over. "Mom," he said again. But this time his voice wouldn't rise. It came out as a hoarse whisper. His hand had begun to throb. "I need to know. Is Becky there? Mom, open the door, please." "Stay away from Becky!" She was backing away from the door. He could hear it. Then came the unmistakable squeal of the kitchen door swinging open, the creak of the linoleum as she walked on it, the sound of the drawer being opened. Suddenly he imagined his mother grabbing for one of the knives. "Before I kill you, monster!" The thought rocked him back on his heels. If she struck out at him, the mark would rise. It would destroy her as it had destroyed Lilith. He dropped his hand and backed up slowly, stumbling down the steps and across the sidewalk, fetching up against the trunk of one of the big trees that shaded the block. He stood where he was, staring at the front door of his house, marked and disfigured with the symbols of his mother's hate for him. No, he reminded himself. She didn't hate him. She thought he was dead. What she hated was something that didn't exist. I am not what she says I am. He didn't know how long he would have stood there, staring, if his phone hadn't begun to ring, vibrating his coat pocket. He reached for it reflexively, noticing that the pattern from the front of the mezuzah, interlocked stars of David, was burned into the palm of his hand. He switched hands and put the phone to his ear. Hello? Simon? It was Clary. She sounded breathless. Where are you? Home, he said, and paused. My mother's house, he amended. His voice sounded hollow and distant to his own ears. Why aren't you back at the Institute? Is everyone all right? That's just it, she said. Just after you left, Maris came back down from the roof where Jace was supposed to be waiting. There was no one there. Simon moved, without quite realizing he was doing it, like a mechanical doll. He began walking up the street toward the subway station. What do you mean there was no one there? Jace was gone, she said, and he could hear the strain in her voice. And so was Sebastian. Simon stopped in the shadow of a bare-branched tree. But Sebastian was dead. He's dead, Clary. Then you tell me why his body isn't there, because it isn't, she said, her voice finally breaking. There's nothing up there but a lot of blood and broken glass. They're both gone. Simon, Jace is gone. Part 1. No Evil Angel. Love is a familiar. Love is a devil. There is no evil angel but love. William Shakespeare. Love's Labor's Lost. 2 weeks later. Chapter 1. The Last Council. How much longer will the verdict take, do you think? Clary asked. She had no idea how long they had been waiting, but it felt like 10 hours. There were no clocks in Isabel's black and hot pink powder puff bedroom, just piles of clothes, heaps of books, stacks of weapons, a vanity overflowing with sparkling makeup, used brushes and open drawers spilling lacy slips, sheer tights, and feather boas. It had a certain backstage at La Caja Fold design aesthetic, but over the past 2 weeks, Clary had spent enough time among the glittering mess to have begun to find it comforting. Isabel, standing over by the window with Church in her arms, stroked the cat's head absently. Church regarded her with baleful yellow eyes. Outside the window, a November storm was in full bloom, rain streaking the windows like clear paint. Not much longer, she said slowly. She wasn't wearing any makeup, which made her look younger, her dark eyes bigger. 5 minutes, probably. Clary, sitting on Izzy's bed between a pile of magazines and a rattling stack of serif blades, swallowed hard against the bitter taste in her throat. I'll be back. 5 minutes. That had been the last thing she had said to the boy she loved more than anything else in the world. Now she thought it might be the last thing she would ever get to say to him. Clary remembered the moment perfectly. The roof garden, the crystalline October night, the stars burning icy white against a cloudless black sky, the paving stones smeared with black runes spattered with ichor and blood, Jace's mouth on hers. The only warm thing in a shivering world. Clasping the Morgenstern ring around her neck, the love that moves the sun and all the other stars. Turning to look for him as the elevator took her away, sucking her back down into the shadows of the building. She had joined the others in the lobby, hugging her mother, Luke, Simon, but some part of her, as it always was, had still been with Jace, floating above the city on that rooftop, the two of them alone in the cold and brilliant electric city. Maris and Kadir had been the ones to get into the elevator to join Jace on the roof and to see the remains of Lilith's ritual. It was another 10 minutes before Maris returned, alone. When the doors had opened and Clary had seen her face, white and set and frantic, she had known. What had happened next had been like a dream. The crowd of shadow hunters in the lobby had surged towards Maris. Alec had broken away from Magnus, and Isabel had leaped to her feet. White bursts of light cut through the darkness like the soft explosions of camera flashes at a crime scene, as one after another, Seraph blades lit the shadows. Pushing her way forward, Clary heard the story in broken pieces. The rooftop garden was empty. Jace was gone. The glass coffin that had held Sebastian had been smashed open. Glass was lying everywhere in fragments. Blood, still fresh, dripped down the pedestal on which the coffin had sat. The shadow hunters were making plans quickly to spread out in a radius and search the area around the building. Magnus was there, his hands sparkling blue, turning to Clary to ask if she had something of Jace's that he could track him with. Numbly, she had given him the Morgenstern ring and retreated into a corner to call Simon. She had only just closed the phone when the voice of a shadow hunter rang out above the rest. Tracking? That'll work only if he's still alive. With that much blood, it's not very likely. Somehow, that was the last straw. Prolonged hypothermia, exhaustion, and shock took their toll, and she felt her knees give. Her mother caught her before she hit the ground. There was a dark blur after that. She woke up the next morning in her bed at Luke's, sitting bolt upright, with her heart going like a trip hammer. Sure, she had had a nightmare. As she struggled out of bed, the fading bruises on her arms and legs told a different story, as did the absence of her ring. Throwing on jeans and a hoodie, she staggered out into the living room to find Jocelyn, Luke, and Simon seated there with somber expressions on their faces. She didn't even need to ask, but she did anyway. Did they find him? Is he back? Jocelyn stood up. Sweetheart, he's still missing. But not dead. They haven't found a body. She collapsed onto the couch next to Simon. No, he's not dead. I'd know. She remembered Simon holding her hand while Luke told her what they did know. That Jace was still gone, and so was Sebastian. The bad news was that the blood on the pedestal had been identified as Jace's. The good news was that there was less of it than they had thought. It had mixed with the water from the coffin to give an impression of a greater volume of blood than there had really been. They now thought it was quite possible he had survived whatever had happened. "But what happened?" she demanded. Luke shook his head, blue eyes somber. "Nobody knows, Clary." Her veins felt as if her blood had been replaced with ice water. "I want to help. I want to do something. I don't want to just sit here while Jace is missing." "I wouldn't worry about that," Jocelyn said grimly. "The Clave wants to see you." Invisible ice cracked in Clary's joints and tendons as she stood up. "Fine. Whatever. I'll tell them anything they want if they'll find Jace." "You'll tell them anything they want because they have the mortal sword." There was despair in Jocelyn's voice. "Oh, baby, I'm so sorry." And now, after 2 weeks of repetitive testimony, after scores of witnesses had been called, after she had held the mortal sword a dozen times, Clary sat in Isabel's bedroom and waited for the council to rule on her fate. She couldn't help but remember what it had felt like to hold the mortal sword. It was like tiny fishhooks embedded in your skin, pulling the truth out of you. She had knelt, holding it, in the circle of the speaking stars, and had heard her own voice telling the council everything. How Valentine had raised the angel Raziel, and how she had taken the power of controlling the angel from him by erasing his name in the sand and writing hers over it. She had told them how the angel had offered her one wish, and she had used it to raise Jace from the dead. She had told them how Lilith had possessed Jace, and Lilith had planned to use Simon's blood to resurrect Sebastian, Clary's brother, whom Lilith regarded as a son. How Simon's mark of Cain had ended Lilith, and they had thought Sebastian had been ended too, no longer a threat. Clary sighed and flipped her phone open to check the time. "They've been in there for an hour," she said. "Is that normal? Is it a bad sign?" Isabel dropped Church, who let out a yowl. She came over to the bed and sat down beside Clary. Isabel looked even more slender than usual. Like Clary, she'd lost weight in the past 2 weeks, but elegant as always in black cigarette pants and a fitted gray velvet top. Mascara was smudged all around Izzy's eyes, which should have made her look like a raccoon, but just made her look like a French film star instead. She stretched her arms out, and her electrum bracelets with their rune charms jingled musically. "No, it's not a bad sign," she said. "It just means they have a lot to talk over." She twisted the lightwood ring on her finger. "You'll be fine. You didn't break the law. That's the important thing." Clary sighed. Even the warmth of Isabel's shoulder next to hers couldn't melt the ice in her veins. She knew that technically she had broken no laws, but she also knew the Clave was furious at her. It was illegal for a shadow hunter to raise the dead, but not for the angel to do it. Nevertheless, it was such an enormous thing she had done in asking for Jace's life back that she and Jace had agreed to tell no one about it. Now it was out, and it had rocked the Clave. Clary knew they wanted to punish her, if only because her choice had had such disastrous consequences. In some way, she wished they would punish her, break her bones, pull her fingernails out, let the Silent Brothers root through her brain with their belated thoughts. A sort of devil's bargain, her own pain for Jace's safe return. It would have helped her guilt over having left Jace behind on that rooftop, even though Isabel and the others had told her 100 times she was being ridiculous, that they had all thought he was perfectly safe there, and that if Clary had stayed, she would probably now be missing too. "Quit it," Isabel said. For a moment, Clary wasn't sure if Isabel was talking to her or to the cat. Church was doing what he often did when dropped, lying on his back with all 4 legs in the air, pretending to be dead in order to induce guilt in his owners. But then Isabel swept her black hair aside, glaring, and Clary realized she was the one being told off, not the cat. "Quit what? Morbidly thinking about all the horrible things that are going to happen to you, or that you wish would happen to you because you're alive and Jace is missing?" Isabel's voice jumped, like a record skipping a groove. She never spoke of Jace as being dead or even gone. She and Alec refused to entertain the possibility. And Isabel had never reproached Clary once for keeping such an enormous secret. Throughout everything, in fact, Isabel had been her staunchest defender. Meeting her every day at the door to the council hall, she had held Clary firmly by the arm as she'd marched past clumps of glaring, muttering shadow hunters. She'd waded through endless council interrogations, shooting dagger glances at anyone who dared look at Clary sideways. Clary had been astonished. She and Isabel had never been enormously close, both of them being the sort of girls who were more comfortable with boys than other female companionship. But Isabel didn't leave her side. Clary was as bewildered as she was grateful. "I can't help it," Clary said. "If I were allowed to patrol, if I were allowed to do anything, I think it wouldn't be so bad." "I don't know." Isabel sounded weary. For the past 2 weeks, she and Alec had been exhausted and gray-faced from 16-hour patrols and searches. When Clary had found out she was banned from patrolling or searching for Jace in any way until the council decided what to do about the fact that she had brought him back from the dead, she'd kicked a hole in her bedroom door. "Sometimes it feels so futile," Isabel added. Ice crackled up and down Clary's bones.
You mean you think he's dead?
No, I don't. I mean, I think there's no way they're still in New York. But they're patrolling other cities, right?
Clary put a hand to her throat, forgetting that the Morgenstern ring no longer hung there.
Magnus was still trying to track Jace, though no tracking had yet worked.
Of course they are.
Isabel reached out curiously and touched the delicate silver bell that hung around Clary's neck now in place of the ring.
What's that?
Clary hesitated. The bell had been a gift from the Seelie Queen.
No, that wasn't quite right.
The Queen of the Fairies didn't give gifts. The bell was meant to signal the Seelie Queen that Clary wanted her help. Clary had found her hand wandering to it more and more often as the days dragged on with no sign of Jace. The only thing that stopped Clary was the knowledge the Seelie Queen never gave anything without the expectation of something terrible in return. Before Clary could reply to Isabel, the door opened. Both girls sat up ramrod straight, Clary clutching one of Izzy's pink pillows so hard that the rhinestones on it dug into the skin of her palms.
Hey.
A slim figure stepped into the room and shut the door. Alec, Isabel's older brother, was dressed in council wear, a black robe figured with silver runes, open now over jeans and a long-sleeved black t-shirt. All the black made his pale skin look paler, his crystal blue eyes bluer. His hair was black and straight like his sister's, but shorter, cut just above his jawline. His mouth was set in a thin line.
Clary's heart started to pound. Alec didn't look happy. Whatever the news was, it couldn't be good.
It was Isabel who spoke.
"How'd it go?" she said quietly. "What's the verdict?"
Alec sat down at the vanity table, swinging himself around the chair to face Izzy and Clary over the back. At another time, it would have been comical. Alec was very tall, with long legs like a dancer, and the way he folded himself awkwardly around the chair made it look like dollhouse furniture.
"Clary," he said,
"Gia Penhallow handed down the verdict.
You're cleared of any wrongdoing. You broke no laws, and Gia feels that you've been punished enough."
Isabel exhaled an audible breath and smiled. For just a moment, a feeling of relief broke through the layer of ice over all of Clary's emotions. She wasn't going to be punished, locked up in the silent city, trapped somewhere where she couldn't help Jace.
Luke, who as the representative of the werewolves on the council had been present for the verdict, had promised to call Jocelyn as soon as the meeting ended, but Clary reached for her phone anyway. The prospect of giving her mother good news for a change was too tempting.
"Clary," Alex said as she flipped her phone open.
"Wait."
She looked at him. His expression was still as serious as an undertaker's. With a sudden sense of foreboding, Clary put her phone back down on the bed.
"Alec, what is it?"
"It wasn't your verdict that took the council so long," said Alec. "There was another matter under discussion." The ice was back. Clary shivered.
"Jace?"
"Not exactly." Alec leaned forward, folding his hands along the back of the chair. "A report came in early this morning from the Moscow Institute. The wardings over Wrangel Island were smashed through yesterday. They've sent a repair team, but having such important wards down for so long, that's a council priority."
Wards, which served, as Clary understood it, as a sort of magical fence system, surrounded Earth, put there by the first generation of Shadow Hunters. They could be bypassed by demons, but not easily, and kept out the vast majority of them, preventing the world from being flooded by a massive demon invasion. She remembered something that Jace had said to her, what felt like years ago. There used to be only small demon invasions into this world, easily contained. But even in my lifetime, more and more of them have spilled in through the wardings.
"Well, that's bad," Clary said. "But I don't see what it has to do with..."
"The Clave has its priorities," Alec interrupted.
"Searching for Jason Sebastian has been top priority for the past 2 weeks, but they've scoured everything,
and there's no sign of either of them in any downworld haunt. None of Magnus's tracking spells have worked. Elodie, the woman who brought up the real Sebastian, Verlag, confirmed that no one's tried to get in touch with her. That was a long shot anyway. No spies have reported any unusual activity among the known members of Valentine's old circle, and the Silent Brothers haven't been able to figure out exactly what the ritual Lilith performed was supposed to do, or whether it succeeded. The general consensus is that Sebastian, of course they call him Jonathan when they talk about him, kidnapped Jace. But that's not anything we didn't know.
So? Isabel said.
What does that mean? More searching? More patrolling?
Alex shook his head.
They're not discussing expanding the search, he said quietly. They're deprioritizing it. It's been 2 weeks and they haven't found anything. The specially commissioned groups brought over from Idris are going to be sent home. The situation with the ward is taking priority now. Not to mention that the council has been in the middle of delicate negotiations, updating the laws to allow for the new makeup of the council, appointing a new consul and inquisitor, determining different treatment of downworlders. They don't want to be thrown completely off track.
Clary stared. They don't want Jace's disappearance to throw them off the track of changing a bunch of stupid old laws?
They're giving up? They're not giving up.
Alec,
Isabel said sharply.
Alec took a breath and put his hands up to cover his face. He had long fingers, like Jace's, scarred like Jace's were as well. The eye mark of the Shadow Hunters decorated the back of his right hand.
Clary, for you, for us, this has always been about searching for Jace. For the Clave, it's about searching for Sebastian. Jace as well, but primarily Sebastian. He's the danger. He destroyed the wards of Alicante. He's a mass murderer. Jace is...
just another Shadow Hunter, said Isabel. We die and go missing all the time.
He gets a little extra for being a hero of the mortal war, said Alec. But in the end, the Clave was clear. The search will be kept up, but right now it's a waiting game. They expect Sebastian to make the next move. In the meantime, it's third priority for the Clave, if that. They expect us to go back to normal life.
Normal life? Clary couldn't believe it. A normal life without Jace?
That's what they told us after Max died, said Izzy, her black eyes tearless but burning with anger. That we'd get over our grief faster if we just went back to normal life.
It's supposed to be good advice, said Alec from behind his fingers.
Tell that to Dad. Did he even come back from Idris for the meeting?
Alec shook his head, dropping his hands. No. If it's any consolation, there were a lot of people at the meeting speaking out angrily on behalf of keeping the search for Jace up at full strength. Magnus, obviously. Luke, Consul Penhallow. Even Brother Zachariah. But at the end of the day, it wasn't enough.
Clary looked at him steadily.
Alec, she said. Don't you feel anything?
Alec's eyes widened, their blue darkening.
And for a moment, Clary remembered the boy who had hated her when she'd first arrived at the Institute. The boy with bitten nails and holes in his sweaters and a chip on his shoulder that had seemed immovable.
I know you're upset, Clary, he said, his voice sharp.
But if you're suggesting that Iz and I care less about Jace than you do...
I'm not, Clary said.
I'm talking about your Parabatai connection. I was reading about the ceremony in the Codex. I know being Parabatai ties the two of you together. You can sense things about Jace, things that will help you when you're fighting. So I guess I mean, can you sense if he's still alive?
Clary, Isabel sounded worried.
I thought you didn't...
He's alive, Alec said cautiously. You think I'd be this functional if he weren't alive? There's definitely something fundamentally wrong. I can feel that much. But he's still breathing.
Could the wrong thing be that he's being held prisoner? Said Clary in a small voice.
Alec looked toward the windows, the sheeting gray rain.
Maybe. I can't explain it. I've never felt anything like it before. But he's alive.
Alec looked at her directly then.
I'm sure of it.
Then screw the council. We'll find him ourselves, Clary said.
Clary, if that were possible, don't you think we already would have?
Alec began.
We were doing what the Clave wanted us to do before, said Isabel.
Patrols, searches.
There are other ways.
Ways that break the law, you mean, said Alec. He sounded hesitant.
Clary hoped he wasn't going to repeat the Shadowhunter's motto when it came to the law.
Sed lex dura lex.
The law is harsh, but it is the law. She didn't think she could take it.
The Seelie Queen offered me a favor, Clary said, at the fireworks party in Idris. The memory of that night, how happy she'd been, made her heart contract for a moment, and she had to stop and regain her breath. And a way to contact her. The Queen of the Fair Folk gives nothing for free. I know that. I'll take whatever debt it is on my shoulders. Clary remembered the words of the fairy girl who had handed her the bell.
You would do anything to save him. Whatever it cost you. Whatever you might owe to hell or heaven. Would you not?
I just want one of you to come with me. I'm not good with translating fairy speak. At least if you're with me, you can limit whatever the damage is. But if there's anything she can do...
I'll go with you, Isabel said immediately.
Alec looked at his sister darkly.
We already talked to the fair folk. The council questioned them extensively, and they can't lie.
The council asked them if they knew where Jace and Sebastian were, Clary said. Not if they'd be willing to look for them. The Seelie Queen knew about my father. Knew about the angel he summoned and trapped. Knew the truth about my blood and Jace's. I think there's not much that happens in this world that she doesn't know about.
It's true, said Isabel, a little animation entering her voice. You know you have to ask fairies the exact right thing to get useful information out of them, Alec. They're very hard to question, even if they do have to tell the truth. A favor, though, is different.
And its potential for danger is literally unlimited, said Alec.
If Jace knew I let Clary go to the Seelie Queen, he'd...
I don't care, Clary said. He'd do it for me. Tell me he wouldn't. If I were missing, he'd burn the whole world down till he could dig you out of the ashes.
I know, Alec said, sounding exhausted.
Hell, you think I don't want to burn down the world right now?
I'm just trying to be...
An older brother, said Isabel.
I get it.
Alec looked as if he were fighting for control.
If something happened to you, Isabel, after Max and Jace...
Izzy got to her feet, went across the room, and put her arm around Alec. Their dark hair, precisely the same color, mixed together as Isabel whispered something into her brother's ear. Clary watched them with not a little envy. She had always wanted a brother, and she had one now. Sebastian. It was like always wanting a puppy for a pet and being handed a hellhound instead. She watched as Alec tugged his sister's hair affectionately, nodded, and released her.
We should all go, he said. But I have to tell Magnus at least what we're doing. It wouldn't be fair not to.
Do you want to use my phone? Isabel asked, offering the battered pink object to him. Alec shook his head.
He's waiting downstairs with the others.
You'll have to give Luke some kind of excuse, too, Clary. I'm sure he's expecting you to go home with him, and he says your mother's been pretty sick about this whole thing.
She blames herself for Sebastian's existence.
Clary got to her feet, even though she thought he was dead all those years.
It's not her fault.
Isabel pulled her golden whip down from where it hung on the wall and wrapped it around her wrist, so that it looked like a ladder of shining bracelets.
No one blames her.
That never matters, said Alec. Not when you blame yourself. In silence, the three of them made their way through the corridors of the Institute, oddly crowded now with other shadow hunters, some of whom were part of the special commissions that had been sent out from Idris to deal with the situation. None of them really looked at Isabel, Alec, or Clary with much curiosity. Initially,
Clary had felt so much as if she were being stared at and had heard the whispered words, "Valentine's daughter," so many times that she'd started to dread coming to the Institute. But she'd stood up in front of the council enough times now that the novelty had worn off. They took the elevator downstairs. The nave of the Institute was brightly lit with witch light as well as the usual tapers, and was filled with council members and their families. Luke and Magnus were sitting in a pew, talking to each other. Beside Luke was a tall, blue-eyed woman who looked just like him. She had curled her hair and dyed the gray brown, but Clary still recognized her. Luke's sister, Amadis. Magnus got up at the sight of Alec and came over to talk to him. Izzy appeared to recognize someone else across the pews and darted away in her usual manner, without pausing to say where she was going. Clary went to greet Luke and Amadis. Both of them looked tired, and Amadis was patting Luke's shoulder sympathetically. Luke rose to his feet and hugged Clary when he saw her. Amadis congratulated Clary on being cleared by the council, and she nodded. She felt only half there, most of her numb, and the rest of her responding on autopilot. She could see Magnus and Alec out of the corner of her eye. They were talking, Alec leaning in close to Magnus, the way couples often seemed to curve into each other when they spoke, in their own contained universe. She was happy to see them happy. But it hurt, too. She wondered if she would ever have that again, or ever even want it again. She remembered Jace's voice. "I don't even want anyone but you."
"Earth to Clary," said Luke. "Do you want to head home? Your mother is dying to see you, and she'd love to catch up with Amadis before she goes back to Idris tomorrow. I thought we could have dinner. You pick the restaurant."
He was trying to hide the concern in his voice, but Clary could hear it. She hadn't been eating much lately, and her clothes had started to hang more loosely on her frame.
"I don't really feel like celebrating," she said. "Not with the council deprioritizing the search for Jace."
"Clary, it doesn't mean they're going to stop," said Luke.
"I know. It's just... it's like when they say a search and rescue mission is now a search for bodies. That's what it sounds like." She swallowed. "Anyway, I was thinking of going to Tacky's for dinner with Isabel and Alec," she said. "Just to do something normal."
Amadis squinted toward the door.
"It's raining pretty hard out there."
Clary felt her lips stretch into a smile. She wondered if it looked as false as it felt.
"I won't melt."
Luke folded some money into her hand, clearly relieved she was doing something as normal as going out with friends.
"Just promise to eat something."
"Okay." Through the twinge of guilt, she managed a real half-smile in his direction before she turned away. Magnus and Alec were no longer where they had been a moment ago. Glancing around, Clary saw Izzy's familiar long black hair through the crowd. She was standing by the Institute's large double doors, talking to someone Clary couldn't see. Clary headed toward Isabel. As she drew closer, she recognized one of the group, with a slight shock of surprise, as Aline Penhallow. Her glossy black hair had been cut stylishly just above her shoulders. Standing next to Aline was a slim girl with pale white gold hair that curled in ringlets. It was drawn back from her face, showing the tips of her ears were slightly pointed. She wore council robes, and as Clary came closer, she saw that the girl's eyes were a brilliant and unusual blue-green, a color that made Clary's fingers yearn for her Prismacolor pencils for the first time in 2 weeks.
"It must be weird, with your mother being the new consul," Isabel was saying to Aline as Clary joined them. "Not that Gia isn't much better than... hey, Clary. Aline, you remember Clary?"
The two girls exchanged nods. Clary had once walked in on Aline kissing Jace. It had been awful at the time, but the memory held no sting now. She'd be relieved to walk in on Jace kissing someone else at this point. At least it would mean he was alive.
"And this is Aline's girlfriend, Helen Blackthorne," Isabel said with heavy emphasis. Clary shot her a glare. Did Isabel think she was an idiot? Besides, she remembered Aline telling her that she kissed Jace only as an experiment to see if any guy were her type.
Apparently, the answer had been no. Helen's family runs the Los Angeles Institute.
Helen, this is Clary Frey.
Valentine's daughter, Helen said. She looked surprised and a little impressed.
Clary winced. I try not to think about that too much.
Sorry, I can see why you wouldn't,
Helen flushed.
Her skin was very pale, with a slight sheen to it, like a pearl.
I voted for the council to keep prioritizing the search for Jace, by the way. I'm sorry we were overruled.
Thanks.
Not wanting to talk about it, Clary turned to Aline.
Congratulations on your mother being made consul.
That must be pretty exciting.
Aline shrugged. She's busy a lot more now.
She turned to Isabel. Did you know your dad put his name in for the Inquisitor position?
Clary felt Isabel freeze beside her.
No, I didn't know that.
I was surprised, Aline added. I thought he was pretty committed to running the Institute here. She broke off, looking past Clary.
Helen, I think your brother is trying to make the world's biggest puddle of melted wax over there. You might want to stop him.
Helen blew out an exasperated breath, muttered something about 12-year-old boys, and vanished into the crowd just as Alec pushed his way forward. He greeted Aline with a hug. Clary forgot sometimes that the Penhallows and the Lightwoods had known each other for years, and looked at Helen in the crowd.
Is that your girlfriend?
Aline nodded.
Helen Blackthorne.
I heard there's some fairy blood in that family, said Alec.
Ah, Clary thought. That explained the pointed ears.
Nephilim blood was dominant, and the child of a fairy and a shadow hunter would be a shadow hunter as well. But sometimes the fairy blood could express itself in odd ways, even generations down the line.
A little, said Aline.
Look, I wanted to thank you, Alec.
Alec looked bewildered.
What for?
What you did in the Hall of Accords, Aline said, kissing Magnus like that. It gave me the push I needed to tell my parents, to come out to them. And if I hadn't done that, I don't think, when I met Helen, I would have had the nerve to say anything.
Oh, Alec looked startled, as if he'd never considered what impact his actions might have had on anyone outside his immediate family.
And your parents? Were they good about it?
Aline rolled her eyes.
They're sort of ignoring it, like it might go away if they don't talk about it.
Clary remembered what Isabel had said about the Clave's attitude toward its gay members.
If it happens, you don't talk about it.
But it could be worse.
It could definitely be worse, said Alec, and there was a grim edge to his voice that made Clary look at him sharply.
Aline's face melted into a look of sympathy.
I'm sorry, she said. If your parents aren't... They're fine with it, Isabel said, a little too sharply.
Well, either way, I shouldn't have said anything right now, not with Jace missing. You must all be so worried.
She took a deep breath.
I know people have probably said all sorts of stupid things to you about him, the way they do when they don't really know what to say. I wanted to tell you something.
She ducked away from a passerby with impatience and moved closer to the Lightwoods and Clary, lowering her voice.
Alec, Izzy, I remember once when you guys came to see us in Idris. I was 13 and Jace was, I think he was 12. He wanted to see Brosselin Forest, so we borrowed some horses and rode there one day. Of course, we got lost. Brosselin's impenetrable. It got darker and the woods got thicker and I was terrified. I thought we'd die there. But Jace was never scared. He was never anything but sure we'd find our way out. It took hours, but he did it. He got us out of there. I was so grateful, but he just looked at me like I was crazy. Like, of course he'd get us out. Failing wasn't an option. I'm just saying, he'll find his way back to you. I know it.
Clary didn't think she'd ever seen Izzy cry, and she was clearly trying not to now. Her eyes were suspiciously wide and shining.
Alec was looking at his shoes. Clary felt a wellspring of misery wanting to leap up inside her, but forced it down. She couldn't think about Jace when he was 12. Couldn't think about him lost in the darkness. Or she'd think about him now, lost somewhere, trapped somewhere, needing her help. expecting her to come, and she'd break. "Aline," she said, seeing that neither Isabel nor Alec could speak. "Thank you." Aline flashed a shy smile. "I meant it."
"Aline!" It was Helen, her hand firmly clamped around the wrist of a younger boy whose hands were covered with blue wax. He must have been playing with the tapers in the huge candelabras that decorated the sides of the nave. He looked about 12, with an impish grin, and the same shocking blue-green eyes as his sister, though his hair was dark brown. "We're back. We should probably go before Jules destroys the whole place. Not to mention that I have no idea where Tibbs and Livy have gone." "They were eating wax," the boy, Jules, supplied helpfully.
"Oh, God," Helen groaned, and then looked apologetic.
"Never mind me. I've got 6 younger brothers and sisters and 1 older. It's always a zoo."
Jules looked from Alec to Isabel and then at Clary. "How many brothers and sisters have you got?" he asked. Helen paled. Isabel said in a remarkably steady voice, "There are 3 of us." Jules' eyes stayed on Clary.
"You don't look alike."
"I'm not related to them," Clary said. "I don't have any brothers or sisters."
"None?"
Disbelief registered in the boy's tone, as if she'd told him she had webbed feet.
"Is that why you look so sad?"
Clary thought of Sebastian, with his ice-white hair and black eyes. "If only," she thought, "if only I didn't have a brother, none of this would have happened." A little throb of hatred went through her, warming her icy blood. "Yes," she said softly. "That's why I'm sad." Chapter 2. Thorns. Helen. Simon was waiting for Clary, Alec, and Isabel outside the Institute, under an overhang of stone that only just protected him from the worst of the rain. He turned as they came out through the doors, and Clary saw that his dark hair was pasted to his forehead and neck. He pushed it back and looked at her, a question in his eyes. "I'm cleared," she said, and as he started to smile, she shook her head. "But they're deprioritizing the search for Jace. I'm pretty sure they think he's dead." Simon looked down at his wet jeans and t-shirt, a wrinkled gray ringer tee that said, "Clearly I have made some bad decisions," on the front in block lettering. He shook his head. "I'm sorry." "The Clave can be like that," Isabel said. "I guess we shouldn't have expected anything else." "Basia cocuum," Simon said, or whatever their motto is. "It's descensus Averno facilis est. The descent to hell is easy," said Alec. "You just said kiss the cook." "Damn it," said Simon. "I knew Jace was screwing with me." His wet brown hair fell back into his eyes. He flicked it away with a gesture impatient enough that Clary caught a flashing glimpse of the silvery mark of Cain on his forehead. "Now what?" "Now we go see the Sealy Queen," said Clary. As she touched the bell at her throat, she explained to Simon about Kaylee's visit to Luke and Jocelyn's reception, and her promises to Clary about the Sealy Queen's help. Simon looked dubious. "The red-headed lady with the bad attitude who made you kiss Jace? I didn't like her." "That's what you remember about her? That she made Clary kiss Jace?" Isabel sounded annoyed. "The Sealy Queen is dangerous. She was just playing around that time. Usually, she likes to drive at least a few humans to screaming madness every day before breakfast." "I'm not human," Simon said. "Not anymore." He looked at Isabel only briefly, dropped his gaze, and turned to Clary. "You want me with you? I think it would be good to have you there. Daylighter, Mark of Cain. Some things have to impress even the Queen."
"I wouldn't bet on it," said Alec.
Clary glanced past him and asked, "Where's Magnus?" "He said it would be better if he didn't come. Apparently, he and the Sealy Queen have some kind of history." Isabel raised her eyebrows.
"Not that kind of history," said Alec irritably.
"Some kind of feud. Though," he added, half under his breath, "the way he got around before me, I wouldn't be surprised."
"Alec!"
Isabel dropped back to talk to her brother, and Clary opened her umbrella with a snap. It was one Simon had bought her years ago at the Museum of Natural History, and had a pattern of dinosaurs on the top. She saw his expression change to one of amusement as he recognized it.
"Shall we walk?" he inquired and offered his arm.
The rain was coming down steadily, creating small rills out of the gutters and splashing water up from the wheels of passing taxis. It was odd, Simon thought, that although he didn't feel cold, the sensation of being wet and clammy was still irritating. He shifted his gaze slightly, looking at Alec and Isabel over his shoulder. Isabel hadn't really met his eyes since they'd come out of the Institute, and he wondered what she was thinking. She seemed to want to talk to her brother, and as they paused at the corner of Park Avenue, he heard her say,
"So, what do you think about Dad putting his name in for the Inquisitor position?
I think it sounds like a boring job." Isabel was holding an umbrella. It was clear plastic, decorated with decals of colorful flowers. It was one of the girliest things Simon had ever seen, and he didn't blame Alec for ducking out from under it and taking his chances with the rain.
"I don't know why he'd want it."
"I don't care if it's boring," Isabel whisper hissed. "If he takes it, he'll be an Idris all the time. Like, all the time. He can't run the Institute and be the Inquisitor. He can't have two jobs at once."
"If you've noticed, Iz, he's an Idris all the time anyway."
"Alec." The rest of what she said was lost as the light changed and traffic surged forward, spraying icy water up onto the pavement. Clary dodged a geyser of it and nearly knocked into Simon. He took her hand to steady her.
"Sorry," she said.
Her hand felt small and cold in his.
"Wasn't really paying attention."
"I know." He tried to keep the worry out of his voice. She hadn't really been paying attention to anything for the past 2 weeks. At first she'd cried, and then been angry. Angry that she couldn't join the patrols looking for Jace. Angry at the council's endless grilling. Angry that she was being kept virtually a prisoner at home because she was under suspicion from the Clave. Most of all, she'd been angry at herself for not being able to come up with a rune that would help. She would sit at her desk at night for hours, her stele clutched so tightly in whitening fingers that Simon was afraid it would snap in half. She'd try to force her mind to present her with a picture that would tell her where Jace was, but night after night, nothing happened. She looked older, he thought as they entered the park through a gap in the stone wall on Fifth Avenue. Not in a bad way, but she was different from the girl she'd been when they had walked into the Pandemonium Club on that night that had changed everything. She was taller, but it was more than that. Her expression was more serious. There was more grace and force in the way she walked. Her green eyes were less dancing, more focused. She was starting to look, he realized with a jolt of surprise, like Jocelyn. Clary paused in a circle of dripping trees. The branches blocked most of the rain here, and Isabel and Clary leaned their umbrellas against the trunks of nearby trees. Clary unclasped the chain around her neck and let the bell slide into her palm. She looked around at all of them, her expression serious. "This is a risk," she said. "And I'm pretty sure if I take it, I can't go back from it. So if any of you don't want to come with me, it's all right. I understand." Simon reached out and put his hand over hers. There was no need to think. Where Clary went, he went. They had been through too much for it to be any other way. Isabel followed suit, and lastly, Alec. Rain dripped off his long black lashes like tears, but his expression was resolute. The four of them held hands tightly. Clary rang the bell. There was a sensation as if the world were spinning. Not the same sensation as being flung through a portal, Clary thought, into the heart of a maelstrom, but more as if she were sitting on a merry-go-round that had begun to spin faster and faster. She was dizzy and gasping when the sensation stopped suddenly and she was standing still again, her hand clasped with Isabel's, Alec's, and Simon's. They released one another, and Clary glanced around. She had been here before, in this dark brown shining corridor that looked as if it had been carved out of a tiger's eye gemstone. The floor was smooth, worn down by the passage of thousands of years' worth of fairy feet. Light came from glinting chips of gold in the walls, and at the end of the passage was a multicolored curtain that swayed back and forth as if moved by wind, though there was no wind here underground. As Clary drew near to it, she saw that it was sewed out of butterflies. Some of them were still alive, and their struggles made the curtain flutter as if in a stiff breeze. She swallowed back the acid taste in her throat.
"Hello?" she called. "Is anyone there?"
The curtain rustled aside, and the fairy knight Meliorn stepped out into the hallway. He wore the white armor Clary remembered, but there was a sigil over his left breast now, the four C's that also decorated Luke's council robes, marking him as a member. There was a scar, also, on Meliorn's face that was new, just under his leaf-colored eyes. He regarded her frigidly.
"One does not greet the queen of the Seelie Court with the barbarous human hello," he said. "As if you were hailing a servant. The proper address is well met."
"But we haven't met," said Clary. "I don't even know if she's here." Meliorn looked at her with scorn.
"If the queen were not present and ready to receive you, ringing the bell would not have brought you. Now come, follow me, and bring your companions with you."
Clary turned to gesture at the others, then followed Meliorn through the curtain of tortured butterflies, hunching her shoulders in the hopes that no part of their wings would touch her. One by one, the four of them stepped into the queen's chamber. Clary blinked in surprise. It looked entirely different from how it had the last time she'd been here. The queen reclined on a white and gold divan, and all around her stretched a floor made of alternating squares of black and white, like a great checkerboard. Strings of dangerous-looking thorns hung from the ceiling, and on each thorn was impaled a will-o'-the-wisp, its normally blinding light flickering as it died. The room shimmered in their glow. Meliorn went to stand beside the queen. Other than him, the room was empty of courtiers. Slowly the queen sat up straight. She was as beautiful as ever, her dress a diaphanous mixture of silver and gold, her hair like rosy copper as she arranged it gently over one white shoulder. Clary wondered why she was bothering. Of all of them there, the only one likely to be moved by her beauty was Simon, and he hated her.
"Well met, Nephilim, Daylighter," she said, inclining her head in their direction. "Daughter of Valentine, what brings you to me?"
Clary opened her hand. The bell shone there like an accusation. "You sent your handmaiden to tell me to ring this if I ever needed your help."
"And you told me you wanted nothing from me," said the queen, "that you had everything you desired."
Clary thought back desperately to what Jace had said when they had had an audience with the queen before. How he had flattered and charmed her. It was as if he had suddenly acquired a whole new vocabulary. She glanced back over her shoulder at Isabel and Alec, but Isabel only made an irritable motion at her, indicating that she should keep going.
"Things change," Clary said.
The queen stretched her legs out luxuriously.
"Very well. What is it you want from me?"
"I want you to find Jace Lightwood."
In the silence that followed, the sound of the will-o'-the-wisps crying in their agony was softly audible. At last the queen said,
"You must think us powerful indeed if you believe the fair folk can succeed where the Clave has failed."
"The Clave wants to find Sebastian. I don't care about Sebastian. I want Jace," Clary said. "Besides, I already know you know more than you're letting on. You predicted this would happen. No one else knew. But I don't believe you sent me that bell when you did, the same night Jace disappeared, without knowing something was brewing."
"Perhaps I did," said the queen, admiring her shimmering toenails.
"I've noticed the fair folk often say perhaps when there's truth they want to hide," Clary said. "It keeps you from having to give a straight answer."
"Perhaps so," said the queen with an amused smile.
"Mayhap is a good word, too," Alec suggested.
"Also perchance," Izzy said.
"I see nothing wrong with maybe," said Simon. "A little modern, but the gist of the idea comes across. The queen waved away their words as if they were annoying bees buzzing around her head.
I do not trust you, Valentine's daughter, she said. There was a time I wanted a favor from you, but that time is over. Meliorn has his place on the council. I am not sure there is anything you can offer me.
If you thought that, said Clary, you never would have sent the bell. For a moment, their eyes locked. The queen was beautiful, but there was something behind her face, something that made Clary think of the bones of a small animal whitening in the sun. At last the queen said,
Very well, I may be able to help you, but I will desire recompense.
Shocker, Simon muttered. He had his hands jammed into his pockets and was looking at the queen with loathing. Alec laughed. The queen's eyes flashed. A moment later, Alec staggered back with a cry. He was holding his hands out before him, gaping, as the skin on them wrinkled and his hands curved inward, bent, the joints swollen, his back hunched, his hair graying, his blue eyes fading and sinking into deep wrinkles. Clary gasped. Where Alec had been, an old man, bent and white-haired, stood trembling.
How swift mortal loveliness does fade, the queen gloated. Look at yourself, Alexander Lightwood. I give you a glimpse of yourself in a mere 60 years. What will your warlock lover say then of your beauty?
Alec's chest was heaving. Isabel stepped quickly to his side and took his arm. Alec, it's nothing. It's a glamour. She turned on the queen. Take it off him! Take it off!
If you and yours will speak to me with more respect, then I might consider it.
We will, Clary said quickly. We apologize for any rudeness. The queen sniffed.
I rather miss your Jace, she said. Of all of you, he was the prettiest and the best mannered.
We miss him too, said Clary in a low voice. We didn't mean to be ill-mannered. We humans can be difficult in our grief.
Hm,
said the queen. But she snapped her fingers, and the glamour fell from Alec. He was himself again, though white-faced and stunned-looking. The queen shot him a superior look and turned her attention to Clary.
There is a set of rings, said the queen. They belong to my father. I desire the return of these objects. For they are fairy-made and possess great power. They allow us to speak to one another, mind to mind, as your silent brothers do. At present, I have it on good authority that they are on display in the Institute.
I remember seeing something like that, Izzy said slowly. 2 fairy-work rings in a glass case on the 2nd floor of the library. You want me to steal something from the Institute? Clary said, surprised. Of all the favors she might have guessed the queen would ask for, this one wasn't high on the list.
It is not theft, said the queen, to return an item to its rightful owners.
And then you'll find Jace for us, said Clary. And don't say perhaps. What will you do exactly?
I will assist you in finding him, said the queen. I give you my word that my help would be invaluable. I can tell you, for instance, why all of your tracking spells have been for naught. I can tell you in what city he is most likely to be found.
But the Clave questioned you, interrupted Simon. How did you lie to them?
They never ask the correct questions.
Why lie to them? Demanded Isabel. Where is your allegiance in all this?
I have none. Jonathan Morgenstern could be a powerful ally if I do not make him an enemy first. Why endanger him or earn his ire at no benefit to ourselves? The fair folk are an old people. We do not make hasty decisions, but first wait to see in what direction the wind blows.
But these rings mean enough to you that if we get them, you'll risk making him angry, Alec asked. But the queen only smiled, a lazy smile. Ripe with promise.
I think that is quite enough for today, she said. Return to me the rings, and we will speak again.
Clary hesitated, turning to look at Alec, and then Isabel. You're all right with this, stealing from the Institute.
If it means finding Jace, Isabel said.
Alec nodded. Whatever it takes.
Clary turned back to the Queen, who was watching her with an expectant gaze.
Then, I think we have ourselves a bargain.
The Queen stretched and gave a contented smile. Fare thee well, little shadow hunters, and a word of warning. Though you have done nothing to deserve it, you might well consider the wisdom of this hunt for your friend. For as is often the happenstance with that which is precious and lost, when you find him again, he may well not be quite as you left him.
It was nearly 11 when Alec reached the front door of Magnus's apartment in Greenpoint. Isabel had persuaded Alec to come to Tacky's for dinner with Clary and Simon, and though he had protested, he was glad he had. He had needed a few hours to settle his emotions after what had happened in the Seelie Court. He did not want Magnus to see how badly the Queen's glamour had shaken him. He no longer had to ring the bell for Magnus to buzz him upstairs. He had a key, a fact he was obscurely proud of. He unlocked the door and headed upstairs, passing Magnus's first-floor neighbor as he did so. Though Alec had never seen the occupants of the first-floor loft, they seemed to be engaged in a tempestuous romance. Once there had been a bunch of someone's belongings strewn all over the landing with a note attached to a jacket lapel addressed to a lying liar who lies. Right now, there was a bouquet of flowers taped to the door with a card tucked among the blooms that read, "I'm sorry." That was the thing about New York. You always knew more about your neighbor's business than you wanted to. Magnus's door was cracked slightly open, and the sounds of music playing softly wafted out into the hall. Today it was Tchaikovsky. Alec felt his shoulders relax as the door of the apartment shut behind him. He could never be quite sure how the place was going to look. It was minimalist right now, with white couches, red stacking tables, and stark black-and-white photos of Paris on the walls. But it had begun to feel increasingly familiar, like home. It smelled like the things he associated with Magnus. Ink, cologne, the burned sugar smell of magic. He scooped up Chairman Meow, who was dozing on the windowsill, and made his way into the study. Magnus looked up as Alec came in. He was wearing what for Magnus was a somber ensemble, jeans and a black t-shirt with rivets around the collar and cuffs. His black hair was down, messy and tangled, as if he'd run his hands through it multiple times in annoyance, and his cat's eyes were heavy-lidded with tiredness. He dropped his pen when Alec appeared and grinned. "The chairman likes you." "He likes anyone who scratches behind his ears," Alec said, shifting the dozing cat so that his purring seemed to rumble through Alec's chest. Magnus leaned back in his chair, the muscles in his arms flexing as he yawned. The table was strewn with pieces of paper covered in small, cramped handwriting and drawings. The same pattern over and over, variations on the design that had been splattered across the floor of the rooftop from which Jace had disappeared.
"How is the Seelie Queen?"
"Same as usual."
"Raging bitch, then?"
"Pretty much." Alec gave Magnus the condensed version of what had happened in the Fairy Court. He was good at that, keeping things short, not a word wasted. He never understood people who chattered on incessantly, or even Jace's love of overcomplicated wordplay.
"I worry about Clary," said Magnus.
"I worry she's getting in over her little red head." Alec set Chairman Meow down on the table, where he promptly curled up into a ball and went back to sleep. "She wants to find Jace. Can you blame her?" Magnus's eyes softened. He hooked a finger into the top of Alec's jeans and pulled him closer.
"Are you saying you'd do the same thing if it were me?"
Alec turned his face away, glancing at the paper Magnus had just set aside. "You looking at these again?"
"Looking a little disappointed."
Magnus let Alec go.
"There's got to be a key," he said, "to unlocking them. Some language I haven't looked at yet. Something ancient. This is old black magic. Very dark. Not like anything I've ever seen before."
He looked at the paper again, his head tilted to the side. Can you hand me that snuff box over there? The silver one, on the edge of the table. Alec followed the line of Magnus's gesture and saw a small silver box perched on the opposite side of the big wooden table. He reached over and picked it up. It was like a miniature metal chest set on small feet, with a curved top and the initials W.S. picked out in diamonds across the top. W, he thought.
Will?
Will, Magnus had said, when Alec had asked him about the name Camille had taunted him with.
Dear God, that was a long time ago.
Alec bit his lip.
What is this?
It's a snuff box, said Magnus, not looking up from his papers. I told you.
Snuff? As in snuffing people out?
Alec eyed it. Magnus looked up and laughed. As in tobacco. It was very popular around the 17th, 18th century. Now I use the box to keep odds and ends in. He held out his hand, and Alec gave the box up.
Do you ever wonder, Alec began, and then started again. Does it bother you that Camille's out there somewhere? That she got away? And that it was my fault?
Alec thought, but didn't say. There was no need for Magnus to know.
She's always been out there somewhere, said Magnus. I know the Clave isn't terribly pleased, but I'm used to imagining her living her life, not contacting me. If it ever bothered me, it hasn't in a long time.
But you did love her, once. Magnus ran his fingers over the diamond insets in the snuff box.
I thought I did.
Does she still love you?
I don't think so, Magnus said dryly. She wasn't very pleasant the last time I saw her. Of course, that could be because I've got an 18-year-old boyfriend with a stamina rune and she doesn't.
Alec sputtered. As the person being objectified, I object to that description of me.
She always was the jealous type, Magnus grinned. He was awfully good at changing the subject, Alec thought. Magnus had made it clear that he didn't like talking about his past love life. But somewhere during their conversation, Alec's sense of familiarity and comfort, his feeling of being at home, had vanished. No matter how young Magnus looked, and right now, barefoot, with his hair sticking up, he looked about 18. Uncrossable oceans of time divided them. Magnus opened the box, took out some tacks, and used them to fix the paper he had been looking at to the table. When he glanced up and saw Alec's expression, he did a double take.
Are you okay?
Instead of replying, Alec reached down and took Magnus's hands. Magnus let Alec pull him to his feet, a questioning look in his eyes. Before he could say anything, Alec drew him closer and kissed him. Magnus made a soft, pleased sound and gripped the back of Alec's shirt, rucking it up, his fingers cool on Alec's spine. Alec leaned into him, pinning Magnus between the table and his own body, not that Magnus seemed to mind.
Come on, Alec said against Magnus's ear. It's late. Let's go to bed.
Magnus bit his lip and glanced over his shoulder at the papers on the table, his gaze fixed on ancient syllables and forgotten languages.
Why don't you go on ahead, he said. I'll join you. 5 minutes.
Sure. Alec straightened up, knowing that when Magnus was deep in his studies, 5 minutes could easily become 5 hours. I'll see you there.
Shh! Clary put her finger to her lips before motioning for Simon to go before her through the front door of Luke's house. All the lights were off, and the living room was dark and silent. She shooed Simon toward her room and headed into the kitchen to grab a glass of water. Halfway there, she froze. Her mother's voice was audible down the hall. Clary could hear the strain in it. Just like losing Jace was Clary's worst nightmare, she knew that her mother was living her worst nightmare, too. Knowing that her son was alive and out there in the world, capable of anything, was ripping her apart from the inside out. But they cleared her, Jocelyn. Clary overheard Luke reply, his voice dipping in and out of a whisper.
There won't be any punishment.
All of it's my fault. Jocelyn sounded muffled, as if she had buried her head against Luke's shoulder.
If I hadn't brought that
creature into the world. Clary wouldn't be going through this now.
You couldn't have known. Luke's voice faded off into a murmur. And though Clary knew he was right, she had a brief, guilty flash of rage against her mother.
Jocelyn should have killed Sebastian in his crib before he'd ever had a chance to grow up and ruin all their lives, she thought, and was instantly horrified at herself for thinking it. She turned and swung back toward the other end of the house, darting into her bedroom and closing the door behind her as if she were being followed. Simon, who had been sitting on the bed playing with his DS, looked up at her in surprise.
Everything okay?
She tried to smile at him. He was a familiar sight in this room. They'd slept over at Luke's often enough when they were growing up. She'd done what she could to make this room hers instead of a spare room. Photos of herself and Simon, the Lightwoods, herself with Jace and with her family, were stuck haphazardly into the frame of the mirror over her dresser. Luke had given her a drawing board, and her art supplies were sorted neatly into a stack of cubbyholes beside it. She had tacked up posters of her favorite animes, Full Metal Alchemist, Rurouni Kenshin, Bleach. Evidence of her Shadowhunter life lay scattered about as well. A fat copy of the Shadowhunter's Codex, with her notes and drawings scribbled into the margins, a shelf of books on the occult and paranormal, her stele atop her desk, and a new globe, given to her by Luke, that showed Idris, bordered in gold, in the center of Europe. And Simon, sitting in the middle of her bed, cross-legged, was one of the few things that belonged both to her old life and her new one. He looked at her with his eyes dark and his pale face, the glimmer of the mark of Cain barely visible on his forehead. "My mom," she said, and leaned against the door. "She's really not doing well."
"Isn't she relieved? I mean, about you being cleared?"
"She can't get past thinking about Sebastian. She can't get past blaming herself. It wasn't her fault the way he turned out. It was Valentine's."
Clary said nothing. She was recalling the awful thing she had just thought, that her mother should have killed Sebastian when he was born.
"Both of you," said Simon, "blame yourselves for things that aren't your fault. You blame yourself for leaving Jace on the roof." She jerked her head up and looked at him sharply. She wasn't aware she'd ever said she'd blamed herself for that, though she did.
"I never..."
"You do," he said. "But I left him. Izzy left him. Alec left him. And Alex is Parabatai. There's no way we could have known. And it might have been worse if you'd stayed."
"Maybe."
Clary didn't want to talk about it. Avoiding Simon's gaze, she headed into the bathroom to brush her teeth and pull on her fuzzy pajamas. She avoided looking at herself in the mirror. She hated how pale she looked, shadows under her eyes. She was strong. She wasn't going to fall apart. She had a plan, even if it was a little insane, and involved robbing the Institute. She brushed her teeth and was pulling her wavy hair back into a ponytail as she left the bathroom, just catching Simon slipping back into his messenger bag a bottle of what was almost surely the blood he'd bought at Tacky's. She came forward and ruffled his hair.
"You can keep the bottles in the fridge, you know," she said, "if you don't like it room temperature."
"Ice-cold blood is worse than room temperature, actually. Warm is best, but I think your mom would balk at me heating it up in saucepans."
"Does Jordan care?"
Clary asked, wondering if in fact Jordan even still remembered Simon lived with him. Simon had been at her house every night for the past week. In the first few days after Jace had disappeared, she hadn't been able to sleep. She had piled 5 blankets over herself, but she'd been unable to get warm. Shivering, she would lie awake, imagining her veins sluggish with frozen blood, ice crystals weaving a coral-like shining net around her heart. Her dreams were full of black seas and ice floes and frozen lakes and Jace, his face always hidden from her by shadows, or a breath of cloud, or his own shining hair as he turned away from her. She would fall asleep for minutes at a time, always waking up with a sick, drowning feeling. The first day the council had interrogated her, she'd come home and crawled into bed. She'd lain there wide awake until there'd been a knock on her window, and Simon had crawled inside, nearly tumbling onto the floor.
He'd climbed onto the bed and stretched out beside her without a word. His skin had been cold from the outside, and he'd smelled like city air and oncoming winter chill. She had touched her shoulder to his, dissolving a tiny part of the tension that clamped her body like a clenched fist. His hand had been cold, but it had been familiar, like the texture of his corduroy jacket against her arm. "How long can you stay?" she had whispered into the darkness. "As long as you want." She turned on her side to look at him. "Won't Izzy mind? She's the one who told me I should come over here. She said you weren't sleeping. And if having me with you will make you feel better, I can stay. Or I could just stay here until you fall asleep." Clary had exhaled her relief. "Stay all night," she said. "Please." He had. That night she had had no bad dreams. As long as he was there, her sleep was dreamless and blank, a dark ocean of nothingness, a painless oblivion. "Jordan doesn't really care about the blood," Simon said now. "His whole thing is about me being comfortable with what I am, get in touch with your inner vampire, blah, blah." Clary slid next to him onto the bed and hugged a pillow. "Is your inner vampire different from your outer vampire?" "Definitely. He wants me to wear midriff-bearing shirts and a fedora. I'm fighting it." Clary smiled faintly. "So your inner vampire is Magnus?" "Wait, that reminds me." Simon dug around in his messenger bag and produced 2 volumes of manga. He waved them triumphantly before handing them to Clary. "Magical Love Gentlemen, volumes 15 and 16, he said. "Sold out everywhere but Midtown Comics." She picked them up, looking at the colorful back-to-front covers. Once upon a time, she would have waved her arms in fangirl joy. Now was all she could do to smile at Simon and thank him. But he had done it for her, she reminded herself. The gesture of a good friend, even if she couldn't even imagine distracting herself with reading right now. "You're awesome," she said, bumping him with her shoulder. She lay down against the pillows, the manga books balanced on her lap. "And thanks for coming with me to the Seely Court. I know it brings up sucky memories for you, but I'm always better when you're there." "You did great. Handled the queen like a pro." Simon lay down next to her, their shoulders touching, both of them looking up at the ceiling, the familiar cracks in it, the glow in the dark paste on stars that no longer shed light. "So you're going to do it. Steal the rings for the queen." "Yes." She let out her held breath. "Tomorrow. There's a local conclave meeting at noon. Everyone will be in it. I'm going in then." "I don't like it, Clary." She felt her body tighten. "Don't like what?" "You having anything to do with fairies? Fairies are liars." "They can't lie. You know what I mean. Fairies are misleaders." "Sounds lame, though." She turned her head and looked at him, her chin against his collarbone. His arm came up automatically and circled her shoulders, pulling her against him. His body was cool, his shirt still damp from the rain. His usually stick-straight hair had dried in wind-blown curls. "Believe me, I don't like getting mixed up with the court. But I do it for you," she said. "And you do it for me, wouldn't you?" "Of course I would. But it's still a bad idea." He turned his head and looked at her. "I know how you feel. When my father died..." Her body tightened. "Jace isn't dead." "I know. I wasn't saying that. It's just, you don't need to say you're better when I'm there. I'm always there with you. Grief makes you feel alone, but you're not. I know you don't believe in religion the same way I do, but you can believe you're surrounded by people who love you, can't you?" His eyes were wide, hopeful. They were the same dark brown they had always been, but different now, as if another layer had been added to their color, the same way his skin seemed both poreless and translucent at the same time. "I believe it," she thought. "I'm just not sure it matters." She knocked her shoulder gently against his again. "So, do you mind if I ask you something? It's personal, but important." A note of wariness crept into his voice. "What is it?" "With the whole Mark of Cain thing,
Does that mean if I accidentally kick you during the night, I get kicked in the shin 7 times by an invisible force? She felt him laugh. Go to sleep, Frey.
Chapter 3 Bad Angels.
Man, I thought you'd forgotten you lived here, Jordan said the moment Simon walked into the living room of their small apartment, his keys still dangling in his hand. Jordan was usually to be found sprawled out on the futon, his long legs dangling over the side, the controller for their Xbox in his hand. Today he was on the futon, but he was sitting up straight, his broad shoulders hunched forward, his hands in the pockets of his jeans, the controller nowhere to be seen. He sounded relieved to see Simon, and in a moment, Simon realized why. Jordan wasn't alone in the apartment. Sitting across from him in a nubbly orange velvet armchair, none of Jordan's furniture matched, was Maya, her wildly curling hair contained in 2 braids. The last time Simon had seen her, she'd been glamorously dressed for a party. Now she was back in uniform, jeans with frayed cuffs, a long-sleeved t-shirt, and a caramel leather jacket. She looked as uncomfortable as Jordan did, her back straight, her gaze straying to the window. When she saw Simon, she clambered gratefully to her feet and gave him a hug.
Hey, she said. I just stopped by to see how you were doing.
I'm fine. I mean, as fine as I could be with everything going on.
I didn't mean about the whole Jace thing, she said. I meant about you. How are you holding up?
Me? Simon was startled. I'm all right. Worried about Isabel and Clary. You know, the Clave was investigating her.
And I heard she got cleared. That's good.
Maya let him go.
But I was thinking about you and what happened with your mom.
How did you know about that?
Simon shot Jordan a look, but Jordan shook his head almost imperceptibly. He hadn't told.
Maya pulled on a braid. I ran into Eric, of all people. He told me what happened and that you'd backed out of Millennium Lent's gigs for the past 2 weeks because of it.
Actually, they changed their name, Jordan said. They're Midnight Burrito now.
Maya shot Jordan an irritated look, and he slid down a little in his seat. Simon wondered what they had been talking about before he'd gotten home.
Have you talked to anyone else in your family?
Maya asked, her voice soft. Her amber eyes were full of concern. Simon knew it was churlish, but there was something about being looked at like that he didn't like. It was as if her concern made the problem real, when otherwise he could pretend it wasn't happening.
Yeah, he said. Everything's fine with my family.
Really? Because you left your phone here. Jordan picked it up from the side table.
And your sister's been calling you about every 5 minutes all day. And yesterday.
A cold feeling spread through Simon's stomach. He took the phone from Jordan and looked at the screen. 17 missed calls from Rebecca.
Crap, he said. I was hoping to avoid this.
Well, she's your sister, said Maya. She was going to call you eventually.
I know, but I've been sort of fending her off. Leaving messages when I knew she wouldn't be there, that kind of thing. I guess I was avoiding the inevitable.
And now? Simon set the phone down on the windowsill.
Keep avoiding it?
Don't. Jordan took his hands out of his pockets. You should talk to her.
And say what?
The question came out more sharply than Simon had intended.
Your mother must have told her something, said Jordan. She's probably worried.
Simon shook his head.
She'll be coming home for Thanksgiving in a few weeks. I don't want her to get mixed up in what's going on with my mom.
She's already mixed up in it. She's your family, said Maya.
Besides, this, what's going on with your mom, all of it, this is your life now.
Then I guess I want her to stay out of it. Simon knew he was being unreasonable, but he didn't seem to be able to help it. Rebecca was special, different. From a part of his life that had so far remained untouched by all this weirdness. Maybe the only part.
Maya threw her hands up and turned to Jordan. Say something to him. You're his Praetorian guard. Come on, said Simon before Jordan could open his mouth. Are either of you in touch with your parents? Your families?
They exchanged quick looks.
No, Jordan said slowly. But neither of us had good relationships with them before.
I rest my case, said Simon. We're all orphans. Orphans of the storm.
You can't just ignore your sister, insisted Maya.
Watch me.
And when Rebecca comes home and your house looks like the set of The Exorcist, and your mom has no explanation for where you are?
Jordan leaned forward, his hands on his knees. Your sister will call the police, and your mom will end up committed.
I just don't think I'm ready to hear her voice, Simon said, but he knew he'd lost the argument.
I have to head back out, but I promise I'll text her.
Well, Jordan said. He was looking at Maya, not Simon, as he said it, as if he hoped she'd notice he'd made progress with Simon and be pleased. Simon wondered if they'd been seeing each other at all during the past 2 weeks when he had been largely absent. He would have guessed no from the awkward way they'd been sitting when he came in, but with these two, it was hard to be sure.
It's a start.
The rattling gold elevator stopped at the third floor of the Institute. Claire took a deep breath and stepped out into the hallway. The place was, as Alec and Isabel had promised her it would be, deserted and quiet. The traffic on York Avenue outside was a soft murmur. She imagined she could hear the brush of dust mites against one another as they danced in the window light. Along the wall were the pegs where the residents of the Institute hung their coats when they came inside. One of Jace's black jackets still dangled from a hook, the sleeves empty and ghostly. With a shiver, she set off down the hallway. She could remember the first time Jace had taken her through these corridors, his careless light voice telling her about shadow hunters, about Idris, about the whole secret world she had never known existed. She had watched him as he talked, covertly, she thought, but she knew now that Jace noticed everything. Watching the light glint off his pale hair, the quick movements of his graceful hands, the flex of the muscles in his arms as he gestured. She reached the library without encountering another shadow hunter and pushed the door open. The room still gave her the same shiver it had the first time she'd seen it. Circular, because it was built inside a tower, the library had a second-floor gallery, railed, that ran along the midpoint of the walls just above the rows of bookshelves. The desk, Claire still thought of as Hodges, rested in the center of the room, carved from a single slab of oak. The wide surface rested on the backs of two kneeling angels. Clary half expected Hodge to stand up behind it, his keen-eyed raven, Hugo, perched on his shoulder. Shaking off the memory, she headed quickly for the circular staircase at the far end of the room. She was wearing jeans and rubber-soled sneakers, and a soundless rune was carved into her ankle. The silence was almost eerie as she bounded up the steps and onto the gallery. There were books up here, too, but they were locked away behind glass cases. Some looked very old, their covers frayed, their bindings reduced to a few strings. Others were clearly books of dark or dangerous magic. Unspeakable cults, the demon's pox, a practical guide to raising the dead. Between the locked bookshelves were glass display cases. Each held something of rare and beautiful workmanship. A delicate glass flacon, whose stopper was an enormous emerald. A crown with a diamond in the center that did not look as if it would fit any human head. A pendant in the shape of an angel, whose wings were clockwork cogs and gears. And in the last case, just as Isabel had promised, a pair of gleaming golden rings shaped like curling leaves. The fairy work as delicate as baby's breath. The case was locked, of course, but the opening rune, Clary biting her lip as she drew it, careful not to make it too powerful lest the glass case burst apart and bring people running, unsnapped the lock. Carefully, she eased the case open. It was only as she slid her steely back into her pocket that she hesitated. Was this really her? Stealing from the Clave to pay the Queen of the Fair Folk? Whose promises, as Jace had told her once, were like scorpions, with a barbed sting and a tail? She shook her head, as if to clear the doubts away,
and froze. The door to the library was opening. She could hear the creak of wood, muffled voices, footsteps. Without another thought, she dropped to the ground, flattening herself against the cold wooden floor of the gallery.
"You were right, Jace," came a voice, coolly amused and horribly familiar from below. "This place is deserted."
The ice that had been in Clary's veins seemed to crystallize, freezing her in place. She could not move, could not breathe. She had not felt a shock this intense since she had seen her father run a sword through Jace's chest. Very slowly, she inched toward the edge of the gallery and looked down, and bit down on her lips savagely to keep herself from screaming. The sloping roof above rose to a point and was set with a glass skylight. Sunlight poured down through the skylight, lighting a portion of the floor like a spotlight on a stage. She could see that the chips of glass and marble and bits of semi-precious stone that were inlaid in the floor formed a design, the angel Raziel, the cup and the sword. Standing directly on one of the angel's outspread wings was Jonathan Christopher Morgenstern. Sebastian. So this was what her brother looked like, really looked like, alive and moving and animated. A pale face, all angles and planes, tall and slim in black gear. His hair was silvery white, not dark as it had been when she had first seen him, dyed to match the color of the real Sebastian Verlax. His own pale color suited him better. His eyes were black and snapping with life and energy. The last time she'd seen him, floating in a glass coffin like Snow White, one of his hands had been a bandaged stump. Now that hand was whole again, with a silver bracelet glittering on the wrist, but nothing visible showed that it had ever been damaged, and more than damaged, had been missing. And there beside him, golden hair shimmering in the pale sunlight, was Jace. Not Jace as she had imagined him so often over the past 2 weeks, beaten or bleeding or suffering or starving, locked away in some dark cell, screaming in pain or calling out for her. This was Jace as she remembered him, when she let herself remember, flushed and healthy and vibrant and beautiful. His hands were careless in the pockets of his jeans, his marks visible through his white t-shirt. Over it was thrown an unfamiliar tan suede jacket that brought out the gold undertones to his skin. He tipped his head back, as if enjoying the feeling of the sun on his face.
"I'm always right, Sebastian," he said. "You ought to know that about me by now."
Sebastian gave him a measured look, and then a smile. Clary stared. It had every appearance of being a real smile. But what did she know? Sebastian had smiled at her before, and that had turned out to be one big lie.
"So where are the books on summoning? Is there any order to the chaos here?"
"Not really. It's not alphabetized. It follows Hodge's special system."
"Isn't he the one I killed?"
"Inconvenient, that," said Sebastian. "Perhaps I should take the upstairs level and you the downstairs." He moved toward the staircase that led up to the gallery. Clary's heart began to pound with fear. She associated Sebastian with murder, blood, pain, and terror. She knew that Jace had fought him, and won once, but had nearly died in the process himself. In a hand-to-hand fight, she would never beat her brother. Could she fling herself from the gallery railing to the floor without breaking a leg? And if she did, what would happen then? What would Jace do? Sebastian had his foot on the lowest step when Jace called out to him. "Wait, they're here, filed under magic, non-lethal."
"Non-lethal? Where's the fun in that?" Sebastian purred.
But he took his foot off the step and moved back toward Jace. "This is quite a library," he said, reading off titles as he passed them. "The Care and Feeding of Your Pet Imp, Demons Revealed." He plucked that one off the shelf and let out a long, low chuckle.
"What is it?" Jace looked up, his mouth curving upward.
Clary wanted to run downstairs and throw herself at him so badly that she bit down on her lip again. The pain was acid sharp.
"It's pornography," said Sebastian,
Look, demons. Revealed. Jace came up behind him, resting one hand on Sebastian's arm for balance as he read over his shoulder. It was like watching Jace with Alec, someone he was so comfortable with he could touch them without thinking about it. But horrible, backward, inside out.
Okay, how can you tell?
Sebastian shut the book and hit Jace lightly on the shoulder with it.
Some things I know more about than you.
Did you get the books?
I got them.
Jace scooped up a stack of heavy-looking tomes from a nearby table. We have time to go by my room? If I could get some of my stuff.
What do you want?
Jace shrugged. Clothes, mostly. Some weapons. Sebastian shook his head. Too dangerous. We need to get in and out fast. Only emergency items.
My favorite jacket's an emergency item, Jace said.
It was so much like hearing him talk to Alec, to any of his friends.
Much like myself, it is both snuggly and fashionable.
Look, we have all the money we could want, said Sebastian. Buy clothes, and you'll be ruling this place in a few weeks. You can run your favorite jacket up the flagpole and fly it like a pennant.
Jace laughed, that soft, rich sound Clary loved.
I'm warning you, that jacket is sexy. The Institute could go up in sexy, sexy flames. Be good for the place, too dismal right now.
Sebastian grabbed the back of Jace's current jacket with a fist and pulled him sideways.
Now we're going.
Hold on to the books.
He glanced down at his right hand, where a slim silver ring glittered. With the hand that wasn't holding on to Jace, he used his thumb to twist the ring.
Hey, Jace said, do you think...
He broke off, and for a moment, Clary thought that it was because he had looked up and seen her. His face was tilted upward, but even as she sucked in her breath, they both vanished, fading like mirages against the air.
Slowly, Clary lowered her head onto her arm. Her lip was bleeding where she had bitten it. She could taste the blood in her mouth. She knew she should get up, move, run away. She wasn't supposed to be here. But the ice in her veins had grown so cold, she was terrified that if she moved, she would shatter.
Alec woke to Magnus's shaking his shoulder.
Come on, sweet pea, he said. Time to rise and face the day.
Alec unfolded himself groggily out of his nest of pillows and blankets and blinked at his boyfriend.
Magnus, despite having gotten very little sleep, looked annoyingly chipper. His hair was wet, dripping onto the shoulders of his white shirt and making it transparent. He wore jeans with holes in them and fraying hems, which usually meant he was planning to spend the day without leaving his apartment.
Sweepy? Alec said.
I was trying it out.
Alec shook his head.
No.
Magnus shrugged.
I'll keep at it.
He held out a chipped blue mug of coffee, fixed the way Alec liked it. Black with sugar. Wake up. Alec sat up, rubbing at his eyes, and took the mug. The first bitter swallow sent a tingle of energy through his nerves. He remembered lying awake the night before and waiting for Magnus to come to bed. But eventually, exhaustion had overtaken him, and he had fallen asleep around 5 a.m.
I'm skipping the council meeting today.
I know, but you're supposed to meet your sister and the others in the park by Turtle Pond. You told me to remind you.
Alec swung his legs over the side of the bed.
What time is it?
Magnus took the mug gently out of his hand before the coffee spilled and set it on the bedside table.
You're fine. You've got an hour.
He leaned forward and pressed his lips against Alec's. Alec remembered the first time they had ever kissed, here in this apartment, and he wanted to wrap his arms around his boyfriend and pull him close. But something held him back. He stood up, disentangling himself, and went over to the bureau. He had a drawer where his clothes were, a place for his toothbrush in the bathroom, a key to the front door. A decent amount of real estate to take up in anyone's life. And yet he couldn't shake the cold fear in his stomach. Magnus had rolled onto his back on the bed and was watching Alec, one arm crooked behind his head.
"Wear that scarf," he said, pointing to a blue cashmere scarf hanging on a peg. "It matches your eyes." Alec looked at it. Suddenly he was filled with hate for the scarf, for Magnus, and most of all, for himself.
"Don't tell me," he said. "The scarf's 100 years old, and it was given to you by Queen Victoria right before she died for special services to the crown or something."
Magnus sat up. "What's gotten into you?" Alec stared at him. "Am I the newest thing in this apartment? I think that honor goes to Chairman Meow. He's only 2. "I said newest, not youngest," Alec snapped. "Who's W.S.? Is it Will?" Magnus shook his head like there was water in his ears. "What the hell? You mean the snuffbox? W.S. is Woolsey Scott. He founded the Preacher Lupus, I know." Alec pulled on his jeans and zipped them up. "You mentioned him before, and besides, he's a historical figure. And his snuffbox is in your junk drawer. What else is in there? Jonathan Shadowhunter's toenail clippers?" Magnus's cat eyes were cold.
"Where is this coming from, Alexander? I don't lie to you. If there's anything about me you want to know, you can ask."
"Bull," Alec said bluntly, buttoning his shirt. "You're kind and funny and all those great things, but what you're not is forthcoming, sweet pea. You can talk all day about other people's problems, but you won't talk about yourself or your history, and when I do ask, you wriggle like a worm on a hook. Maybe because you can't ask me about my past without picking a fight about how I'm going to live forever and you're not," Magnus snapped. "Maybe because immortality is rapidly becoming the third person in our relationship, Alec." "Our relationship isn't supposed to have a third person."
"Exactly." Alec's throat tightened. There were 1,000 things he wanted to say, but he had never been good with words like Jace and Magnus were. Instead, he grabbed the blue scarf off its peg and wrapped it defiantly around his neck. "Don't wait up," he said. "I might patrol tonight." As he slammed out of the apartment, he heard Magnus yell after him. "And that scarf, I'll have you know, is from the Gap. I got it last year." Alec rolled his eyes and jogged down the stairs to the lobby. The single bulb that usually lit the place was out, and the space was so dim that for a moment, he didn't see the hooded figure slipping toward him from the shadows. When he did, he was so startled that he dropped his keychain with a rattling clang. The figure glided toward him. He could tell nothing about it, not age or gender or even species. The voice that came from beneath the hood was crackling and low.
"I have a message for you, Alec Lightwood," it said, "from Camille Belcourt."
"Do you want to patrol together tonight?" Jordan asked, somewhat abruptly. Maya turned to look at him in surprise. He was leaning back against the kitchen counter, his elbows on the surface behind him. There was an unconcern about his posture that was too studied to be sincere. That was the problem with knowing someone so well, she thought. It was very hard to pretend around them, or to ignore it when they were pretending, even if it would be easier.
"Patrol together?" she echoed.
Simon was in his room, changing clothes. She told him she'd walked to the subway with him, and now she wished she hadn't. She knew she should have contacted Jordan since the last time she'd seen him, when, rather unwisely, she'd kissed him. But then Jace had vanished and the whole world seemed to have blown into pieces, and it had given her just the excuse she'd needed to avoid the whole issue. Of course, not thinking about the ex-boyfriend who had broken your heart and turned you into a werewolf was a lot easier when he wasn't standing right in front of you, wearing a green shirt that hugged his leanly muscled body in all the right places and brought out the hazel color of his eyes. "I thought they were canceling the patrol searches for Jace," she said, looking away from him. "Well, not canceling so much as cutting down. But I'm Preacher, not Clave. I can look for Jace on my own time." "Right," she said. He was playing with something on the counter, arranging it, but his attention was still on her. "Do you, you know, you used to want to go to college at Stanford. Do you still?" Her heart skipped a beat. "I haven't thought about college since," she cleared her throat. "Not since I changed." His cheeks flushed.
"You were, I mean,
You always wanted to go to California. You were going to study history, and I was going to move out there and surf, remember? Maya shoved her hands into the pockets of her leather jacket. She felt as if she ought to be angry, but she wasn't. For a long time, she had blamed Jordan for the fact that she'd stopped dreaming of a human future, with school, and a house, and a family, maybe, someday. But there were other wolves in the police station pack who still pursued their dreams, their art. That, for instance. It had been her own choice to stop her life short. "I remember," she said. His cheeks flushed. "About tonight. No one searched the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So I thought, but it's never much fun doing it on my own. But if you don't want to..." "No," she said, hearing her own voice as if it were someone else's. "I mean, sure. I'll go with you." "Really?" His hazel eyes lit up, and Maya cursed herself inwardly. She shouldn't get his hopes up. Not when she wasn't sure how she felt. It was just so hard to believe that he cared that much. The Preacher Lupus medallion gleamed at his throat as he leaned forward, and she smelled the familiar scent of his soap, and under that, wolf. She flicked her eyes up toward him, just as Simon's door opened and he came out, shrugging on a hoodie. He stopped dead in his doorway, his eyes moving from Jordan to Maya, his eyebrows slowly rising. "You know, I can make it to the subway on my own," he said to Maya, a faint smile tugging the corner of his mouth. "If you want to stay here..." "No." Maya hastily took her hands out of her pockets, where they had been balled into nervous fists. "No, I'll come with you. Jordan, I'll see you later." "Tonight," he called after her. But she didn't turn around to look at him. She was already hurrying after Simon. Simon trudged alone up the low rise of the hill, hearing the shouts of the frisbee players in the sheep meadow behind him, like distant music. It was a bright November day, crisp and windy, the sun lighting what remained of the leaves on the trees to brilliant shades of scarlet, gold, and amber. The top of the hill was strewn with boulders. You could see how the park had been hacked out of what had once been a wilderness of trees and stone. Isabel sat atop one of the boulders, wearing a long dress of bottle green silk, with an embroidered black and silver coat over it. She looked up as Simon strode toward her, pushing her long, dark hair out of her face. "I thought you'd be with Clary," she said as he drew closer. "Where is she?" "Leaving the Institute," he said, sitting down next to Isabel on the rock and shoving his hands into his windbreaker pockets. "She texted. She'll be here soon." "Alex on his way," she began, and broke off as his pocket buzzed. Or, more accurately, the phone in his pocket buzzed. "I think someone's messaging you." He shrugged. "I'll check it later." She gave him a look from under her long eyelashes. "Anyway, I was saying, Alex on his way too. He had to come all the way from Brooklyn, so..." Simon's phone buzzed again. "All right, that's it. If you're not getting it, I will." Isabel leaned forward, against Simon's protest, and slipped her hand into his pocket. The top of her head brushed his chin. He smelled her perfume. Vanilla, and the scent of her skin underneath. When she pulled the phone out and drew back, he was both relieved and disappointed. She squinted at the screen. "Rebecca? Who's Rebecca?" "My sister." Isabel's body relaxed. "She wants to meet you. She says she hasn't seen you since..." Simon swiped the phone out of her hand and flipped it off before shoving it back into his pocket. "I know, I know. Don't you want to see her?" More than almost anything else. "But I don't want her to know about me." Simon picked up a stick and threw it. "Look what happened when my mom found out. So set up a meeting with her somewhere public, where she can't freak out. Far from your house. Even if she can't freak out, she can still look at me like my mother did," Simon said in a low voice. "Like I'm a monster." Isabel touched his wrist lightly. "My mom tossed out Jace when she thought he was Valentine's son and a spy. Then she regretted it horribly. My mom and dad are coming around to Alex being with Magnus. Your mom will come around too,
Get your sister on your side. That'll help. She tilted her head a little. I think sometimes siblings understand more than parents. There's not the same weight of expectations. I could never, ever cut Alec off. No matter what he did. Never. Or Jace. She squeezed his arm, then dropped her hand. My little brother died. I won't ever see him again. Don't put your sister through that.
Through what?
It was Alec, coming up the side of the hill, kicking dried leaves out of his path. He was wearing his usual ratty sweater and jeans, but a dark blue scarf that matched his eyes was wrapped around his throat. Now, that had to have been a gift from Magnus, Simon thought. No way would Alec have thought to buy something like that himself. The concept of matching seemed to be beyond him. Isabel cleared her throat. Simon's sister. She got no further than that. There was a blast of cold air, bringing with it a swirl of dead leaves. Isabel put her hand up to shield her face from the dust as the air began to shimmer with the unmistakable translucence of an opening portal, and Clary appeared before them, her steely in one hand, and her face wet with tears. Chapter 4 And Immortality.
"And you're totally sure it was Jace?" Isabel asked, for what seemed to Clary like the 47th time.
Clary bit down on her already sore lip and counted to 10.
"It's me, Isabel," she said. "You honestly think I wouldn't recognize Jace?"
She looked up at Alec standing over them, his blue scarf fluttering like a pennant in the wind.
"Could you mistake someone else for Magnus?"
"No, not ever," he said without missing a beat. His blue eyes were troubled, dark with worry.
I mean, of course we're asking. It doesn't make any sense."
"He could be a hostage," said Simon, leaning back against a boulder. The autumn sunlight turned his eyes the color of coffee grounds. "Like Sebastian is threatening him that if Jace doesn't go along with his plans, Sebastian will hurt someone he cares about." All eyes went to Clary, but she shook her head in frustration.
"You didn't see them together. Nobody acts like that when they're a hostage.
He seemed totally happy to be there."
"Then he's possessed," Alec said, "like he was by Lilith." "That's what I thought at first. But when he was possessed by Lilith, he was like a robot. He just kept saying the same things over and over. But this was Jace. He was making jokes like Jace does, smiling like him."
"Maybe he has Stockholm Syndrome," Simon suggested. "You know, when you get brainwashed and start sympathizing with your captor."
"It takes months to develop Stockholm Syndrome," Alec objected. "How did he look? Hurt or sick in any way? Can you describe them both?"
It wasn't the first time he'd asked. The wind blew dry leaves around their feet as Clary told them again how Jace had looked, vibrant and healthy. Sebastian, too. They had seemed completely calm. Jace's clothes had been clean, stylish, ordinary. Sebastian had been wearing a long black wool trench coat that had looked expensive.
"Like an evil Burberry ad," Simon said when she was done. Isabel shot him a look. "Maybe Jace has a plan," she said. "Maybe he's tricking Sebastian, trying to get into his good graces, figure out what his plans are."
"You'd think that if you were doing that, he'd have figured out a way to tell us about it," Alec said. "Not to leave us panicking. That's too cruel."
"Unless he couldn't risk sending a message. He'd believe we would trust him. We do trust him."
Isabel's voice rose, and she shivered, wrapping her arms around herself. The trees lining the gravel path they stood on rattled their bare branches.
"Maybe we should tell the Clave," Clary said, hearing her own voice as if from a distance. I don't see how we can handle this on our own."
"We can't tell the Clave." Isabel's voice was hard.
"Why not? If they think he's cooperating with Sebastian, the mandate will be to kill him on sight," Alec said. "That's the law."
"Even if Isabel's right?
Even if he's just playing along with Sebastian?"
Simon said, a note of doubt in his voice.
trying to get on his side to get information? There's no way to prove it. And if we claimed it was what he's doing, and that got back to Sebastian, he'd probably kill Jace, said Alec. If Jace is possessed, the Clave will kill him themselves. We can't tell them anything. His voice was hard. Clary looked at him in surprise. Alec was normally the most rule-abiding of them all.
This is Sebastian we're talking about, said Izzy. There's no one the Clave hates more, except Valentine, and he's dead. But practically everyone knows someone who died in the Mortal War, and Sebastian's the one who took the wards down.
Clary scuffed at the gravel underfoot with her sneaker. The whole situation seemed like a dream, like she might wake up at any moment. Then what next? We talk to Magnus. See if he has any insight. Alec tugged on the corner of his scarf. He won't go to the council. Not if I ask him not to.
He'd better not, said Isabel indignantly. Otherwise, worst boyfriend ever.
I said he wouldn't. Is there any point now, Simon said, in seeing the Seely Queen? Now that we know Jace is possessed, or maybe hiding out on purpose.
You don't miss an appointment with the Seely Queen, Isabel said firmly. Not if you value your skin the way it is.
But she'll just take away the rings from Clary and we won't learn anything, Simon argued. We know more now. We have different questions for her now. She won't answer them, though. She'll just answer the old ones. That's how fairies work. They don't do favors. It's not like she's going to let us go talk to Magnus and then come back.
It doesn't matter.
Clary rubbed her hands across her face. They came away dry. At some point, her tears had stopped coming, thank God. She hadn't wanted to face the Queen looking like she'd just been bawling her eyes out.
I never got the rings.
Isabel blinked.
What?
After I saw Jace and Sebastian, I was too shaken to get them. I just raced out of the Institute and portaled here.
Well, we can't see the Queen then, said Alec. If you didn't do what she asked you to, she'll be furious.
She'll be more than furious, said Isabel. You saw what she did to Alec last time we went to the court, and that was just a glamour. She'll probably turn Clary into a lobster or something.
She knew, Clary said. She said, when you find him again, he may well not be quite as you left him.
Seely Queen's voice drifted through Clary's head. She shivered. She could understand why Simon hated fairies so much. They always knew exactly the right words that would lodge like a splinter in your brain, painful and impossible to ignore or remove.
She's just playing around with us. She wants those rings. But I don't think there's any chance she'll really help us.
Okay, Isabel said doubtfully. But if she knew that much, she might know more. And who else is going to be able to help us since we can't go to the Clave?
Magnus, Clary said. He's been trying to decode Lilith's spell all this time. Maybe if I tell him what I saw, it'll help.
Simon rolled his eyes. It's a good thing we know the person who's dating Magnus, he said. Otherwise, I get the feeling we'd all just lie around all the time wondering what the hell to do next, or try to raise the money to hire Magnus by selling lemonade.
Alec looked merely irritated by this comment. The only way you could raise enough money to hire Magnus by selling lemonade is if you put meth in it.
It's an expression. We are all aware that your boyfriend is expensive. I just wish we didn't have to go running to him with every problem.
So does he, said Alec.
Magnus has another job today, but I'll talk to him tonight, and we can all meet at his loft tomorrow morning.
Clary nodded. She couldn't even imagine getting up the next morning. She knew the sooner they talked to Magnus, the better. But she felt drained and exhausted, as if she'd left pints of her blood on the library floor in the Institute.
Isabel had moved closer to Simon.
I guess that leaves us the rest of the afternoon, she said. Should we go to Tacky's? They'll serve you blood.
Simon glanced over at Clary, clearly worried.
Do you want to come?
No, it's okay. I'll grab a cab back to Williamsburg. I should spend some time with my mom. All this stuff with Sebastian has her falling apart already, and now...
Isabel's black hair flew in the wind as she whipped her head back and forth. You can't tell her what you saw. Luke's on the council. He can't keep it from them.
and you can't ask her to keep it from him.
I know.
Clary looked at the three anxious gazes fixed on her.
How had this happened? She thought.
She, who had never kept secrets from Jocelyn, not real ones anyway, was about to go home and hide something enormous from both her mother and Luke. Something she could talk about only with people like Alec and Isabel Lightwood and Magnus Bane, people that 6 months ago she hadn't known existed. It was strange how your world could shift on its axis, and everything you trusted could invert itself in what seemed like no time at all. At least she still had Simon. Constant, permanent Simon. She kissed him on the cheek, waved her goodbye to the others, and turned away, aware that all three of them were watching her worriedly as she strode across the park, the last dead fall leaves crunching under her sneakers as if they were tiny bones. Alec had lied. It wasn't Magnus who had something to do that afternoon. It was himself. He knew what he was doing was a mistake, but he couldn't help himself. It was like a drug, this needing to know more. And now, here he was, underground, holding his witchlight and wondering just what the hell he was doing. Like all New York subway stations, this one smelled of rust and water, metal and decay. But unlike any other station Alec had ever been in, it was eerily quiet. Aside from the marks of water damage, the walls and platform were clean. Vaulted ceilings, punctuated by the occasional chandelier, rose above him, the arches patterned in green tile. The nameplate tiles on the wall read City Hall in block lettering. The City Hall subway station had been out of use since 1945. Though the city still kept it in order as a landmark. The 6 train ran through it on occasion to make a turnaround, but no one ever stood on this platform. Alec had crawled through a hatch in City Hall Park surrounded by dogwood trees to reach this place, dropping down a distance that would probably have broken a mundane's legs. Now he stood, breathing in the dusty air, his heart rate quickening. This was where the letter the vampire subjugate had handed him in Magnus's entryway had directed him to go. At first he had determined he would never use the information, but he had not been able to bring himself to throw it away. He had balled it up and shoved it into his jeans pocket, and all through the day, even in Central Park, it had eaten at the back of his mind. It was like the whole situation with Magnus. He couldn't seem to help worrying at it the way one might worry at a diseased tooth, knowing you were making the situation worse, but not being able to stop. Magnus had done nothing wrong. It wasn't his fault he was hundreds of years old, and that he had been in love before. But it corroded Alec's peace of mind just the same. And now, knowing both more and less about Jace's situation than he had yesterday, it was too much. He needed to talk to someone, go somewhere. Do something. So here he was. And here she was. He was sure of it. He moved slowly down the platform. The ceiling vaulted overhead, a central skylight letting in light from the park above, 4 lines of tiles radiating out from it like a spider's legs. At the end of the platform was a short staircase, which led up into the gloom. Alec could detect the presence of a glamour. Any mundane looking up would see a concrete wall, but he saw an open doorway. Silently, he headed up the steps. He found himself in a gloomy, low-ceilinged room. An amethyst glass skylight let in a little light. In a shadowy corner of the room sat an elegant velvet sofa with an arched, gilded back. And on the sofa sat Camille. She was as beautiful as Alec remembered. Though she had not been at her best the last time he had seen her, filthy and chained to a pipe in a building under construction. She wore a neat black suit now, with high-heeled red shoes, and her hair spilled down her shoulders in waves and curls. She had a book open on her lap, La Place de l'Étoile by Patrick Modiano. He knew enough French to translate the title, The Place of the Star. She looked at Alec as if she had expected to see him. "Hello, Camille," he said. She blinked slowly. "Alexander Lightwood," she said.
I recognized your footsteps on the stairs.
She put the back of her hand against her cheek and smiled at him. There was something distant about her smile. It had all the warmth of dust.
I don't suppose you have a message from Magnus for me?
Alex said nothing.
Of course not, she said. Silly me. As if he knows where you are.
How did you know it was me? He said. On the stairway.
You're a Lightwood, she said. Your family never gives up. I knew you wouldn't let well enough alone after what I said to you that night. The message today was just to prod your memory.
I didn't need to be reminded of what you promised me. Or were you lying?
I would have said anything to get free that night, she said. But I wasn't lying.
She leaned forward, her eyes bright and dark at the same time.
You are Nephilim of the Claven Council. There's a price on my head for murdering shadow hunters. But I already know you have not come here to bring me to them. You want answers.
I want to know where Jace is, he said.
You want to know that, she said. But you know there's no reason I'd have the answer, and I don't. I'd give it to you if I did. I knew he was taken by Lilith's son, and I have no reason to have any loyalty to her. She is gone. I know there have been patrols out looking for me, to discover whatever I might know. I can tell you now, I know nothing. I would tell you where your friend is if I knew. I have no reason to further antagonize the Nephilim.
She ran a hand through her thick blonde hair.
But that's not why you're here, admitted Alexander.
Alec felt his breath quicken. He had thought of this moment, lying awake at night beside Magnus, listening to the warlock breathing, hearing his own breaths, numbering them out, each breath a breath closer to aging and dying, each night spinning him closer to the end of everything. You said you knew a way to make me immortal, said Alec. You said you knew a way Magnus and I could be together forever.
I did, didn't I? How interesting.
I want you to tell it to me now.
And I will, she said, setting down her book. For a price.
No price, said Alec. I freed you. Now you'll tell me what I want to know, or I'll give you to the Clave. They'll chain you on the roof of the Institute and wait for sunrise. Her eyes went hard and flat.
I do not care for threats.
Then give me what I want. She stood up, brushing her hands down the front of her jacket, smoothing the wrinkles.
Come and take it from me, Shadow Hunter.
It was as if all the frustration, panic, and despair of the past weeks exploded out of Alec. He leaped for Camille, just as she started for him, her fanged teeth snapping outward. Alec barely had time to draw his Seraph blade from his belt before she was on him. He had fought vampires before. Their swiftness and force was stunning. It was like fighting the leading edge of a tornado. He threw himself to the side, rolling onto his feet, and kicked a fallen ladder in her direction. It stopped her briefly enough for him to lift the blade and whisper, Nuriel. The light of the Seraph blade shot up like a star, and Camille hesitated, then flung herself at him again. She attacked, ripping her long nails along his cheek and shoulder. He felt the warmth and wetness of blood. Spinning, he slashed at her, but she rose into the air, darting just out of reach, laughing and taunting him. He ran for the stairs leading down to the platform. She rushed after him. He dodged aside, spun, and pushed off the wall into the air, leaping toward her just as she dived. They collided midair, her screaming and slashing at him, him keeping a firm hold on her arm, even as they crashed to the ground, almost getting the wind knocked out of him. Keeping her earthbound was the key to winning the fight, and he silently thanked Jace, who had made him practice flips over and over in the training room until he could use almost any surface to get himself airborne for at least a moment or two. He slashed with the Seraph blade as they rolled across the floor, and she deflected his blows easily, moving so fast she was a blur. She kicked at him with her high heels, stabbing his legs with their points. He winced and swore, and she responded with an impressive torrent of filth that involved his sex life with Magnus, her sex life with Magnus, and there might have been more had they not reached the center of the room, where the skylight above beamed a circle of sunshine onto the floor. Seizing her wrist, Alec forced Camille's hand down into the light. She screamed as enormous white blisters appeared on her skin. Alec could feel the heat from her bubbling hand. Fingers laced with hers, he jerked her hand upright, back into the shadows. She snarled and snapped at him. He elbowed her in the mouth, splitting her lip. Vampire blood, shimmering bright red, brighter than human blood, dripped from the corner of her mouth. "Have you had enough?" he snarled. "Do you want more?" He began to force her hand back toward the sunlight. It had already begun to heal, the red, blistered skin fading to pink. "No!" she gasped, coughed, and began to tremble, her whole body spasming. After a moment, he realized she was laughing. Laughing up at him through the blood. "Made me feel alive, little Nephilim. A good fight like that. I should thank you." "Thank me by giving me the answers to my question," Alec said, panting. "Or I'll ash you. I'm sick of your games." Her lips stretched into a smile. Her cuts had healed already, though her face was still bloody. "There is no way to make you immortal. Not without black magic or turning you into a vampire, and you have rejected both options." "But you said there was another way we could be together." "Oh, there is," her eyes danced. "You may not be able to give yourself immortality, little Nephilim, at least not on any terms that would be acceptable to you. But you can take Magnus's away." Clary sat in her bedroom at Luke's, a pen clutched in her hand, a piece of paper spread out on the desk in front of her. The sun had gone down, and the desk light was on, blazing down on the rune she had just begun. It had started to come to her on the L train home as she'd stared unseeingly out the window. It was nothing that had ever existed before, and she had rushed home from the station while the image was still fresh in her mind, brushing away her mother's inquiries, closing herself in her room, putting pen to paper. A knock came on the door. Quickly, Clary slid the paper she was drawing on under a blank sheet as her mother came into the room. I know, Jocelyn said, holding up a hand against Clary's protest. "You want to be left alone, but Luke made dinner, and you should eat." Clary gave her mother a look. "So should you." Jocelyn, like her daughter, was given to loss of appetite under stress, and her face looked hollow. She should have been preparing for her honeymoon now, getting ready to pack her bags for somewhere beautiful and far away. Instead, the wedding was postponed, indefinitely, and Clary could hear her crying through the walls at night. Clary knew that kind of crying, born out of anger and guilt. A crying that said, "This is all my fault." "I'll eat if you will," Jocelyn said, forcing a smile. "Luke made pasta." Clary turned her chair around, deliberately angling her body to block her mother's view of her desk. "Mom," she said, "there was something I wanted to ask you." "What is it?" Clary bit the end of her pen, a bad habit she'd had since she'd started to draw. "When I was in the Silent City with Jace, the brothers told me there's a ceremony performed on Shadowhunters at birth. A ceremony that protects them, that the Iron Sisters and the Silent Brothers have to perform it. And I was wondering if the ceremony was ever performed on you?" Clary nodded. Jocelyn exhaled and pushed her hands through her hair. "It was," she said. "I arranged it through Magnus. A Silent Brother was present, someone sworn to secrecy, and a female warlock who took the place of the Iron Sister. I almost didn't want to do it. I didn't want to think you could be in danger from the supernatural after I'd hidden you so carefully. But Magnus talked me into it. And he was right." Clary looked at her curiously. "Who was the female warlock?" "Jocelyn!" It was Luke calling from the kitchen. "The water's boiling over!" Jocelyn dropped a quick kiss on Clary's head. "Sorry, culinary emergency. See you in 5? Clary nodded as her mother hurried from the room, then turned back to her desk. The rune she had been creating was still there, teasing the edge of her mind. She began to draw again, completing the design she had started. As she finished, she sat back and stared at what she'd made. It looked a little like the opening rune, but wasn't. It was a pattern as simple as a cross,
and as new to the world as a just-born baby. It held a sleeping threat, a sense that it had been born out of her rage and guilt and impotent anger. It was a powerful rune. But though she knew exactly what it meant and how it could be used, she couldn't think of a single way in which it could possibly be helpful in the current situation. It was like having your car break down on a lonely road, rooting desperately around in the trunk, and triumphantly pulling out an electrical extension cord instead of jumper cables. She felt as if her own power was laughing at her. With a curse, she dropped her pen onto the desk and put her face in her hands.